Okay, so of course, let me begin by thanking Luca and Céline for the kind invitation, and also Perimeter for their great hospitality. And okay, so let me jump straight in and give some motivations. So of course, I think we all share the same motivations, namely the observation that symmetries, they are a very precious tool to understand classical general relativity, and hopefully also give a notion of quantum general relativity. Of course, in the gravitational context, you can also see from this conference that there are many symmetry groups which have appeared and which have been studied. I list a few of them here. Of course, the historical one, the BMS group. Then people, through various motivations, have introduced the extended BMS group, the generalized BMS group. I never know which one is which. There's BMS Weyl group, Lambda BMS, Luca and Rob just talked about this universal corner symmetry group, and I list a bunch of people who have immensely contributed to this. And so, of course, this brings a natural question. The question is, what is the largest symmetry group which we should think about and work with in gravity? A bit more precise question is maybe how much structure should we try to relax and allow for in the kind of solution space, in the theory that we are describing? Because in the end, it's this extra structure which will govern, in a sense, the size of this symmetry group which we want to study. And you can think, if you think about the original kind of BMS work, you can think about going into two directions. One of these directions is going to very subleading order, so digging very deep into the subleading structure of the Bondi gauge. So this is, for example, what Laurent and Anna talked about, what Daniele did also, looking at these higher spin charges and the very subleading BMS charges. What you can also do is go in the opposite direction and ask about what is the overleading structure. Can you relax some structure in general relativity that will contribute in an overleading sense? So our goal, so this is, of course, based on this paper with Céline. And our goal was to be very general and to step back a bit and construct a framework in which you can include all sorts of things and then discuss what is the implication of this. So these things that we can include are cosmological constant, as you will see, time-dependent free boundary metric, and also logarithmic terms. The extra motivation is to kind of unify, and for us it was very precious to build up upon previous work by many people listed here, including people, of course, who have studied the Bondi gauge with a non-zero cosmological constant. So there are lots of very deep and interesting works, but sometimes phrased in a different language. So our goal was to kind of put everything together to be able to compare and contrast and understand a bit better all the differences between these possibilities. Also, you will see that we will a bit revisit the construction of the so-called Neumann-Unti gauge. This was studied in details by Glenn and Pierre-Henri, but using the Neumann-Penrose formulation, so you will see that we will give revisit this in a more Einstein tensorial language. And also, if I have time, I would like to illustrate some of the applications of this in three dimensions where we can understand and control everything very nicely. So the setup for this is this so-called partial Bondi gauge. So the idea of this partial Bondi gauge is very simple, is that you only impose three conditions on the metric, namely that these two components are vanishing. This gives this metric in a Bondi form. Now you can, of course, notice that at this point there is a freedom in redefining the radial coordinates, because if I change the radial coordinate, I pick up a du square term, and I also pick up a du dr and a du dxa. So this preserves the form of this family of metrics. And now what is very important is that for the transverse metric, we're going to assume something which people sometimes call polyhomogeneous expansion for the metric, meaning that we include logarithmic terms here. I will not go into the details because I don't think I fully understand yet, but one of the motivations for this, this was explained by Winnicourt, is that if the shear actually created by some scattering of incoming particles has a 1 over u term, then you can show that you need the logarithmic term in the transverse metric. Then there was work by Christo Dulu showing that this actually happens. These 1 over u terms in the shear are created by scattering of massive particles. And I think recently, Ashok Sen and his collaborators showed that this also happens for massless particles. This is a very generic phenomenon in just classical general relativity, which points to the fact that you need to include logarithmic terms in your solution space. So let's be general and include these logarithmic terms. And then the philosophy is that we will let the Einstein equations decide from there on and just follow and not choose anything by hand, just let the Einstein equations decide. Of course, this is an incomplete gauge fixing because they have only fixed three conditions. So to complete the gauge fixing with the fourth condition, there are two very known further gauge fixings. One of them is called the Bondy-Zaks gauge. So there are two versions of this Bondy-Zaks gauge. The historical one is this algebraic condition in which you relate the determinant to the determinant of a fixed round sphere metric. Glenn Barnish and Cédric Trossard have suggested to relax this into a differential condition to allow for wide rescalings of the boundary metric. What's important is that this determinant condition actually implies, as you can check easily, that fixes actually the traces of all these coefficients in the expansion of the metric. And in particular, at leading order, you will find that this object CAB, which as you may know is the shear, is actually traceless. So CAB is transverse traceless, it has 2 degrees of freedom. These are the polarizations of gravitational radiation. And in this gauge, R, this radial distance, is actually a luminosity distance. So completing the gauge amounts in a sense to picking what you mean by the radial coordinate. Now there is another gauge called the Newman-Unti gauge. And in the Newman-Unti gauge, again, there are two versions of this Newman-Unti gauge. The algebraic condition, the historical Newman-Unti gauge, is to just set beta equal to 0. What we suggest with Céline is to actually transform this into a differential condition. As you will see, this allows you to have a free boundary metric. What's very important is that in this gauge, as you will see, the trace of C is completely free. So there is an extra mode which is hanging around, which is the trace of the shear, which is not set to 0 by anything. If you want to set it to 0, you have to argue why you can set it to 0. And in this gauge, the geometrical interpretation of the radius is that it's the affine parameter for this null vector. Okay, now once you have this gauge, you want to go ahead and solve the Einstein equations. So I just want to go through this with you to, yes?
This last statement is irrespective of the fact that you modify a bit the gauge, right?
Which last statement?
The last statement of your previous transparency.
Ah, the affine parameter?
Yeah.
Yes.
This is true for any Newman-Unti,
yes, that's
even
true
though
any
you
Newman.
Relax a bit the yes. Newman-Unti. All right.
Any
right.
Newman-Unti gauge. If you compute the affinity of this null geodesics, it's dr squared, in fact. If just dr is 0, that's fine. Yes. Okay, now let's just go through the solving the Einstein equations to see the information that's encoded in there, because there's very interesting information. So I take the Einstein equations with a cosmological constant, and what's very nice is that even with this partial gauge fixing, so I don't complete the gauge fixing to Newman-Unti or Bondy-Zaks, even with this, you have this nice so-called Bondy hierarchy of Einstein equations, and you can solve them in a very specific order, in an exact, well, perturbative way, but you can solve everything. The first equation is the purely radial equation. This actually fixes beta. This is a first order differential equation, and actually at first order, you have a term which is an integration constant, an integration function, which usually we throw away by hand, but our philosophy here was to just let the Einstein equations decide and keep everything that the Einstein equations give to us. So let's keep this integration constant. And then you see at subleading order, you have expressions like this, and D is the trace of DAB. So again, if now you want to fix the gauge to Bondy-Zaks, it's the determinant condition which is fixing the traces. This will fix the value of D. If you want to fix the gauge to Newman-Unti, it's the vanishing of beta after beta naught, which determines the trace, as you can see here. Now the second equation is the radial and angular equation. This is a second order differential equation. It has two integration constants. The first one is this U naught, which again, usually apart from, for example, the work of Romain, Adrien, and Geoffrey, I think also Glenn, you can keep this integration constant. And then at order 1 over R3, you have this NA, which is the angular, the bare angular momentum aspect. Also importantly, you see that here you have logarithmic terms which appear. This logarithmic term, let me call it LAB, and you see it's a combination of the trace-free part of DAB and the trace-free part of CAB, which I denote with this bracket, Now we have to be explicit about the fact that these objects are traceful or trace-free, because as you hopefully see, we have not fixed the traces yet, because this is fixed by the further gauge condition. So again, we want to keep these logarithmic terms, so let's keep them and see what happens with them, how they propagate. Now you solve the next Einstein equation. This is the radial and U equation. You see, for example, contributions here which are very overleading with respect to the usual falloffs. This is due to the cosmological constants. You see here, for example, that you have this trace mode appearing. You also see something a bit unusual from the point of view of the usual BMS setup, namely the fact that you have time derivative of the leading boundary metric Q, which usually we discard in the typical BMS approach. And you have here this integration constant which appears. And again, this equation is first order, and you have an integration constant, which is the bare mass aspect m. Now, what's very interesting is that V1 has some complicated expression. The only things which are free are in purple here. V1 is some complicated mess. Now, there is very interesting information encoded in the purely angular Einstein equations. So you study them order by order. The first equation you find is this very beautiful relationship, which you should study depending on whether lambda is vanishing or not. You see, if lambda is 0, the left-hand side is 0, so in the flat case, this equation is just constraining for you the shape of the time evolution of the boundary metric. It tells you that the time evolution of the boundary metric is not completely arbitrary, but has to respect this equation here. If, on the other hand, you are in DS or ADS, lambda is not 0, this equation is telling you that the shear is not an independent quantity, but is actually determined by what is on the right-hand side. So this is the reason, in a sense, why if you are in DS or ADS, if you remove this boundary source and if you don't allow the boundary metric to be time-varying, you're, in a sense, trivializing your system a lot, because there is no notion of shear, and there is nothing to pick up on the boundary what you would identify as gravitational radiation. So this, you can read this interesting information from this equation. At the next order, you have also something very interesting, which is this a term which is just lambda times this logarithmic term. This is telling you that if you are in DS or ADS, well, you have to set this logarithmic term to be vanishing. This is just manifestation of the statement that in DS or ADS, the solution space actually never has logarithmic branches. So this is the first manifestation of this. And then if you study the fine structure of this solution space, you will see everywhere popping up equations telling you that all these logarithmic terms, they are multiplied by lambda, and they have to vanish if you are in DS or ADS. But if you are in the flat case, you don't get this constraint. And again, these logarithmic terms are completely free, and we want to keep them. Okay, at the next order now.
Can I do a quick question? Yeah. You said in DS and ADS, you said, okay, there's somehow you're not seeing the gravitational radiation. Is it that you don't see it in the shear and it shows up? I mean, it should show up somewhere else, right? In like a subleading.
Well, you know, a bit later, I will identify a candidate notion of radiation in DS and ADS, and I will do that in a minute. And indeed, it's a bit more than. Yeah, there's okay. Another contribution.
But like in ADS, there's the usual holographic dictionary and boundary sources, like the boundary stress tensor, that kind of stuff is.
Yeah, we'll get that to.
Okay.
We'll get to this in a minute.
Sure. Okay.
Hopefully, it will answer your question. But so this is saying that something very peculiar is happening in DS or ADS if you set this right-hand side to zero, you lose a notion of CAB. Okay, at next order, you have an evolution equation for this logarithmic term. This is an equation which was already written in the old paper by Winnicourt. We have a slight generalization of this equation on the right-hand side. It's not very important for our purposes. Now, at the next order, you have the evolution equation for this so-called spin 2 tensor. Remember, this is the 1 over r component of the angular metric. This is an evolution equation which was studied in details by Grant and Nichols, and then also Laurent, Daniele, and Anna Maria, and they, in particular, Laurent, Daniele, and Anna Maria, used this equation to show that it actually is related to the sub-leading soft theorem. Now you also get a very interesting equation if you go at any order n. At any order n, you have an equation which is relating the time evolution of the n minus 1 component, or the term of order 1 over r minus 1 in the angular metric, to lambda times the term of order n. This equation is telling you that if you are in DS or ADS, the left-hand side is not vanishing. Therefore, the time evolution of all these quantities is actually determined by these quantities here. This is actually telling you that in DS or ADS, you only have a finite amount of information you have to specify the geometry. Because all these subleading contributions, well, they are actually determined by overleading contributions. And you see, of course, that if you are in the flat case, you have zero on the left-hand side, and now you have genuine evolution equations for all these infinite amount of quantities that you have to satisfy. So this is showing you that, well, something that we know, of course, but it's very manifest here, that the structure of the solution space is extremely different in the flat case and in DS or ADS. In one case, you have a finite amount of information. In the other case, you have this infinite tower of quantities. Yeah, Laurent.
Just to go back to the question of Anthony, so suppose you put the shear to zero, like, you know, in the usual case, then what does become free? EAB becomes a free data?
Yes, EAB is.
Okay, so the spin 2 object is.
And you will see that EAB
now
appears in the radiation in the ADS case.
But if I understand, like, n equal 2 is different from n bigger than 2 or something.
Yes. Okay. This is why I wrote n greater than 2 here.
Okay.
And then, as usual, in these last remaining Einstein equations, you have the evolution of the angular momentum and the evolution of the mass. And this is just well known. So just to summarize the structure of this, I check the time, the structure of this solution space. So this is a solution space which contains a lot of additional decorations. So you have seen the cosmological constants. These boundary forces, these integration constants which we kept, you see that they actually enter the induced boundary metric on Scry. So you have beta naught here. Here you have U naught, and here you have the leading transverse metric QAB, which usually we unleash when we go from the usual BMS, historical BMS conditions to, I never know which one, generalized or extended BMS. We also have a time dependency of the boundary metric, logarithmic terms, and also this trace mode. And this trace mode is essentially the only thing differentiating at this stage the choice between Bondi-Sachs gauge and the Neumann-Unti gauge. So now to continue, I will not keep everything here because this would be too not very illustrative. I will focus on some of these contributions and tell you what happens in some cases. I will freely set some of these things to zero to show you some very specific things. So in particular, if you want to write the equations of motion, if you want to do this in this tensorial Einstein form, it's very daunting because you have relaxed too many things and things get completely out of hand. So it's much more convenient to switch to the Neumann-Penrose formalism. So the Neumann-Penrose formalism, I just make a small technical remark first. Usually, if you're familiar with the formalism, you think that you know that the Neumann-Penrose formalism usually is set up in the Neumann-Unti gauge. This is why the name Neumann is common to Neumann-Penrose and Neumann-Unti. And this is done so that you actually have some of the spin coefficients which are naturally zero, and this simplifies a lot the equations. So here, the fact that that you are not choosing between Neumann-Unti gauge or Bondi-Sachs gauge does not mean that you can do that you cannot do a Neumann-Penrose formulation. Of course, it just means that you have to be a bit careful about how to set up your Neumann-Penrose formalism and how to choose your tetrad vectors. But, okay, it's just a side remark. Now you do what you do as usual in the Neumann-Penrose formulation: you compute the Weyl tensor and you project the Weyl tensor on your null tetrads, and you read the incoming radiation psi naught, the angular momentum psi 1, the mass psi 2, there is this current in psi 3, and the outgoing radiation in psi 4. What you should immediately notice here is that the peeling of the Weyl tensor is broken because you have these overleading contributions due to the logarithmic terms. You have a 1 over r4 in psi naught instead of the usual 1 over r5. And you also have a contribution overleading with respect to the angular momentum aspect. So this is what some people call logarithmic asymptotic flatness. Simone has a question.
Yeah, just to make sure, if you are writing these formulas now, I guess that those choices are not just not necessary, they're even forbidden now.
Which choices?
Pi equals zero, for instance. Aren't you requiring that the dial is tangent to the cross sections?
You can access them.
So, no, this I don't understand how you can access them.
But I can explain to you. In the paper, we don't have this. So, these things are not zero.
Yeah, I always thought that it was incompatible to require that the N, that the auxiliary null was parallel transported. We're requiring that it was adapted to the bond defoliation, which is what you're using in those formulas.
No, it's not.
No?
I can tell you more details. So here we have these logarithmic terms which break the peeling. But again, many people have this extensive discussion and debate about this. And this is, of course, not problematic. This was discussed by many people, in particular, very recent interesting work by Leonhard Kerberger. Also from this, what you typically do, the motivation from doing this is that it identifies for you objects which are now called covariant functionals. I put this between brackets here. I will explain why. For example, again, if I turn off, for example, this boundary metric for simplicity, this is now the new covariant spin 2 tensor. So you see these logarithmic contributions and also a contribution from this trace mode. And this is the new covariant mass. You see the contribution from the time dependency of the boundary metric and the contribution from the cosmological constant. I'm putting covariant functionals between quotation marks because actually here, if you have this violated peeling because of the logarithmic terms, it turns out that these subleading contributions, EAB and PA, they are not actually covariant under BMS VIL anymore. And this is something which we tried hard to fix, and it looks like you cannot actually bypass this. So you lose somehow this notion of the fact that the asymptotic symmetry group is selecting for you by the requirement of homogeneous transformation of the functionals, is selecting for you nicely behaved functionals. So there's probably a technical way to solve this, but at least you encounter this problem here.
Can I ask you about it? So
yes.
If you take the, you said epsilon AB and PA, so these are the terms that have at that order a log R appearing.
Yes.
So do I understand that they are not invariant under BMSW as they are not invariant under W inside BMSW, and that's the reason? Is that when you send R to R times a function, you pick up a shift contribution? Is that the reason?
It could be the reason. I don't want to say yes to... Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
But you can check that the overleading terms, they are invariant. This transforms homogeneously, this also, but not the lower leading ones.
Okay, thanks. Okay.
But in any case, you can identify these objects, and then you can play with them and see where they appear. Also, the last remark on this slide is that this includes what, I don't know if it's standard to call this like that, but shear free gravitational radiation, meaning that this radiation tensor, curly NAB, is actually non-vanishing, even if the shear CAB is completely set to zero. This is because NAB also has a contribution from the time evolution of the boundary metric. This is what you want, for example, in DS or ADS. No, it's, I can show you. In the case du of q is zero, there is some extra, there is a spin 2 in here, if that's what you're looking for. NAB has the usual time derivative of the news plus some lambda terms with EAB and plus some time derivative of the. Yes.
So N is lambda EAB.
It will appear in a minute, yes. You will. Oh, yes? Okay. So now what's nice, the whole point of doing Newman-Penrose was to be able to write down the evolution equations. So you can write the evolution equations. In Newman-Penrose, you get them from the Bianchi identities. And now you can separate two cases. In the case lambda equal to zero, you get this evolution of the mass, the angular momentum, and the spin 2. And the point really of using Newman-Penrose is that if you were to compute this using the tensorial Einstein equations, because we have unleashed all these things, this would be absolutely completely impossible. But you can do it with Newman-Penrose, and everything is nicely written in terms of these so-called covariant functionals. And you see, in particular, that the logarithmic term appears in the evolution of the angular momentum and also in the evolution of the spin 2. Here it disappears if the time evolution of the boundary metric is 0. But here it does not disappear because it multiplies the Ricci of the boundary. So here it's completely inevitable. And I think that this calls for a re-understanding of the soft theorems, and in particular the logarithmic contributions to the soft theorems, which should modify the subleading and the sub-subleading soft theorems. Now, if lambda is non-vanishing, you can also write a formula for the evolution of the mass. It's not a Bondi mass loss type of formula because the right-hand side is not negative definite, but still you can write this evolution equation. You see that you have this trace mode hanging also here. And what's important for what follows is that you see what was playing the role of NAB here in the flat case is now shifted by lambda squared times the spin 2 EAB. And let's call this SAB because it will reappear in a minute. Now, another thing which you can look at, which is interesting, is the symplectic structure. So we know that generically, as soon as you start relaxing your boundary conditions, something not so nice will happen, namely that the charges will have radial divergences when r goes to infinity. And this you can actually cure by this process called symplectic renormalization. This is a bit a fancy word for to just say the fact that you can actually always do this. To see that, you can just use the fact that the on-shell variation of the Lagrangian is just the exterior derivative of the symplectic potential. If I write this now explicitly in coordinates, you see that this dr of theta r will actually pick up the divergent contributions in the radial component of the symplectic potential. This means that these contributions, which are divergent, you can always write them as a total variation, an angular derivative. This will not contribute to the symplectic structure, and the corner term here. This means that you can always actually cure these divergences of the charges by symplectic renormalization. This is always guaranteed. In the paper, we checked that you can actually explicitly write these divergent contributions in the form of a corner term. But you know that you can always do that. So now you can write the symplectic potential in the flat case. So the first thing to notice is that in the flat case, well, we can take the flat limit of what we did. And here, I just want, it's maybe a technical remark, but to say that the flat limit is well defined. And you don't need actually to use an extra corner term to have a well-defined flat limit. Because if you are working in the Bondi gauge from the onset, everywhere at most you have lambda which is appearing. You will never have a factor of 1 over lambda. So it will never be divergent. I believe it's correct to say that in this reference, a corner term was needed because I think they arrived at some of the results through the Pfeffermann-Gram gauge. And when you map from one gauge to the other like this, the mapping can be up to corner terms, which then you are missing and you need if you want to take, for example, the flat limit. So here the flat limit is well defined. And again, I don't give you the complete expression because it's not very interesting, but I can illustrate the fact that now in Neumann-Unti gauge, if I keep only this trace mode and the boundary metric QAB, which is free, you see that this trace mode actually appears in the symplectic structure as conjugated to QAB, and also as conjugated to the Ricci scalar. So you see that this works if the Ricci scalar is not equal to 2. Otherwise, this will drop from the symplectic structure. If you are in generalized BMS, you will see this contribution of the trace mode.
Sorry, Mark, I didn't understand how come you don't need to renormalize if you seem to be relaxing compared to the compare works.
No, you need to renormalize, but I'm just saying that it's a bit easy or trivial or can always renormalize, right? So the first point was
but
just
I see no corner term needed.
Yeah, I didn't write them, in fact.
So it diverges, and you're renormalizing?
Yeah, here I just wrote the finite contribution of theta. So theta r has also divergent pieces, and these divergent pieces, by construction, you can always cancel them by a corner term, which is just this. So they're not very interesting, if you want. Because you know that you can always deal with them. That's why I only write the finite piece of the symplectic structure.
So you use a corner term. I'm sorry, I'm confused.
No.
You do renormalization. You need to subtract this.
There is a corner term for the renormalization.
Yeah.
But I don't need one for the flat limit. These are That's what confuses you.
Okay, this is the first point. The
yeah,
first bullet
when
point.
When I say no corner
me.
Term is needed, that's for the flat limit.
And how is that? Okay, because in Geoffrey, you are more relaxed, but you don't need to.
No. So with respect to Geoffrey, we still need to renormalize.
Okay.
And this you do with the corner term.
Okay.
And this you can do. That's the first step.
Mm-hmm.
But with respect to Geoffrey, Adrien, Romain, if you want to take the flat limit, then you don't need an extra corner term.
Ah. Okay.
Because some technical reasons, but.
Okay. Sorry. Thanks.
You have another question.
Oops. So this statement that you can always renormalize, so does it apply to your setup where you generalized, you relaxed the bond gauge in a given way, or do you think it's, so I haven't understood if it is general that whatever thing you do, you can
always renormalize. Yeah, it's general. That's the general argument, is that you see by just this simple argument, you get that the divergent piece of the symplectic structure is always of this form. And this
so why then I haven't got it? So why is it always guaranteed that is a pure corner term?
Well, because of this relationship, right? The variation of the Lagrangian on shell is d theta.
Yes.
D theta is just this. And now in this radial derivative, the finite piece of theta r will drop. And you will just be left with the divergent piece of theta r here.
So why there cannot be divergences in r in the other places? Like in this du, theta u?
Well, because delta L will drop from the symplectic structure because delta square is zero. The total angular derivative will drop because it's a total derivative. You will just be left with this. Okay. This is divergent. It's this divergent piece. But this is exactly the corner term you need to remove the divergency. I can show you an example if you want. Sorry, I didn't mean to create confusion with this.
I could do some self-advertisement. This general argument was developed by Aldo and Florian of Miller,
yeah, I think
right?
It's right. Yeah,
so that's there's the general explanation yeah. of how you renormalize.
I didn't mean to create this is not specific to what we're doing here, this partial Bondi gauge or anything. This just means that it's so general that I don't need to discuss it here because it always works, regardless of what you relax, right? You can always do that. So now, just to go back to this was just to illustrate the fact that this trace mode C appears in the symplectic structure. And now you can think that maybe it appears because I have chosen the wrong definition of nous and shear. So just as a remark here, what we use as the nous here is the derivative of the trace-free part of CAB. So really what appears in the radiation. If you use this as the nous, you have the usual nous times shear contribution, and you have this extra term which you cannot get rid of. Now, if lambda is non-vanishing, well, now in this case, this is the case in which you have 1 over lambda contributions. Because you remember that we had this equation of motion earlier telling us that if lambda is non-vanishing, lambda times CAB is the time variation of the leading boundary metric. So it means that CAB is not independent. And if I want to write the symplectic structure in DS or ADS, I have to replace everywhere the shear CAB by 1 over lambda times this contribution. Now, if you do that, you massage the symplectic structure for a very long time. And if you recall that you have introduced the subject SAB, which is the radiation tensor, so this is psi 4 plus this spin 2 piece, well, you find the symplectic potential for what would be, in this case, lambda BMS vial, because we have kept this vial factor, you have the covariant mass here, and conjugated to QAB, you have this tensor SAB. This is just to illustrate this shift of the radiation tensor by this EAB. Okay. So now, of course, what we are interested in is the structure of the asymptotic symmetries. So again, to do this, you first look at the asymptotic Killing vectors. It starts, as usual, by preserving the 2-gauge, or rather the 3-gauge conditions which we have imposed to reach the partial Bondi gauge. If you preserve this gauge condition, you will find that the U component is this free function. The angular component has this usual expression. And now, you have to say something about the radial part of the vector field. And this comes from actually preserving the expansion which we have chosen for the transverse metric. This is why, for example, you also have logarithmic terms in this vector field here. Now, in this vector field, all these functions are free. And it turns out that these functions will be determined once you actually complete the gauge fixing. once you decide if you are in Bondi-Zaks or Newman-Unti or any other choice of radial coordinate that you want. So that's what I mean here. To determine this free function in psi r, you need to further reduce the gauge to, for example, Bondi-Zaks or Newman-Unti. So for example, if you reduce the gauge to Bondi-Zaks, preserving the Bondi-Zaks gauge fixing will tell you that in this radial vector field, you have only one free function of time and the angle that's appearing at order r, and that's this function h, which is here. And this is just the Weyl rescaling of the boundary metric. Now what's kind of curious is that if you go to the Newman-Unti gauge now, you find that there is an extra function which is free, because the radial vector field in Newman-Unti gauge is the one in Bondi-Zaks gauge, plus an extra free function at order zero, which we call k. Now you can compute the adjusted bracket for these field-dependent vectors, and you will find that the algebra spanned by this is this double semi-direct product structure. You have diffeomorphisms of scribe plus, and an abelian piece corresponding to the Weyl transformations, and an abelian piece corresponding to these radial translations k. Now the transformation laws to illustrate this. Well, as we said, h is just the Weyl transformation. So it transforms this volume element in the familiar way. And now these translations, where they start to act is actually on CAB. And on CAB, well, this is interesting if you go, of course, to Newman-Unti gauge, where the trace of CAB is free. And you find that in Newman-Unti gauge, the trace of C is actually shifted by this function K. This was actually used explicitly, this transformation, to actually reach a Newman-Unti gauge in which you set C to zero. For example, in this paper by Luc Blanchet, Geoffrey Comper, Guillaume Fay, Roberto, and Ali Serrage, they were interested in mapping the, relating this to the multipolar expansion, which you usually do in harmonic gauge. And then when mapping from harmonic gauge to Newman-Unti gauge, they ended up with a C which was not vanishing. And then they explicitly used this symmetry to set C to zero. So of course, the question is whether you can do this legally, or whether there's actually a non-vanishing charge associated with this transformation K. So to do this, we would need to compute the charge. In fact, in four dimensions, it's a bit complicated. And unfortunately, I cannot tell you complete results about this yet. I can tell you that K appears in the charge, but for reasons which will hopefully be clear now, you should not just, you have to further manipulate the charge to be sure that you have a meaningful result. So I cannot really conclude that K is physical at this stage. So to go further, now I just switch to three dimensions, where you can reproduce many of these things and see that indeed you have some extra structure already in three dimensions. So in three dimensions, we, now that we did the 4D case, the 3D case is exactly analogous, you will see. So I start with this partial Bondi gauge. I have these three functions, beta, v, u, and w here. W is the transverse metric in 3D. Now I complete the gauge, and now let me go straight to this differential Newman-Unti gauge, where beta has just a free function beta naught. And I relax the determinant condition. This can have a radial dependency. Now the solution space is easy because you're in three dimensions. You can actually get the exact solution of the 3D Einstein equations. So the exact solution, keeping a cosmological constant, has this form for w, u, and v. What's important here to see is that, well, again, you have this integration constant u naught, you have this integration constant phi naught, and you have this c, which here, c is exactly the analog of the c we had in four dimensions, in the sense that you see it's a subleading term in the angular metric. That's why I also denoted by C in this case. So as I said, C is the exact analog of the trace C in four dimensions. And again, the boundary metric depends on these extra fields, beta naught, phi naught, and u naught. Now you can again look at the asymptotic symmetries. They are generated now again by four free functions. So F are super translations, G are super rotations. The term of order R is the Weyl rescaling. And you have, again, this free function k, which is this radial translation. In particular, you see that, again, as in four dimensions, k is just shifting the value of c. if you set C to 0 by hand, you have to kill this freedom in having this transformation K. Now the algebra in three dimensions has a slightly different structure than in 4D. It's again, you have 2 abelian copies, but you see H and K have kind of switched role, and here it's a direct sum instead of a semi-direct sum. So up to these minor differences, it's the exact same structure as in four dimensions. Now this 3D model is also interesting because it's kind of, or at least I find it interesting because it, to solve it, you need to kind of play with all these ambiguities and tricks which exist in the covariant phase space. Namely, you have to play with corner terms. So of course, we are interested in the algebra of the charges, and because this is 3D gravity, you expect that the charges are integrable, because 3D gravity has no degrees of freedom, so there's no radiation, there is no news, so the charges should be integrable. It turns out that here, if you want the charges to be integrable, you have to do three things. So first, you have to do this symplectic renormalization to have a finite charge. So this you can do with this corner term, which has this R contribution. Now to get integrable charges, you have to do two things. First, you have to use a corner ambiguity. You have to add by hand a corner term. And then you have to use this, I think Adrien already mentioned this, this so-called integrable slicing. This is just a fancy word for saying the fact that, of course, in this asymptotic killing vector, F, G, H, and K, they are completely free integration constants, or rather functions. So these functions, you can take them to be any arbitrary, also field-dependent function. You can redefine them in an arbitrary field-dependent manner. And this arbitrariness is this so-called choice of slicing. So here we just say that in addition to using this corner term, you have to properly choose, guess, the field dependency in the asymptotic killing vector. Well, not guess, because you can make this mathematically rigorous, but you can find a solution to this. I just make a side remark here, which is just technical. You can ask yourself now, is there a way to understand the origin of these corner terms? Because I'm saying that to get integrable charges in this 3D example, I need to add these two corner terms. Now you would like this procedure to be not very ambiguous. You would like to ask, do these corner terms, do they come from somewhere? Or do I just have to guess them by hand? In fact, they come from somewhere, and they come from what you could call a relative corner term. What is this relative corner term? It's just the expression of the fact that, as you may know, if you take the second order Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian and the first order Palatini Lagrangian, they are of course equal on shell, but the symplectic structures, they are not equal on shell. They differ by a boundary term. So this boundary term is a codimension 2, so it's really a corner term. This is the relative corner term relating Einstein-Hilbert to Einstein-Cartan. Written in tetrad variables, or rather triad variables, that's the expression for this corner term. This is a one form. Oh, this is dead. No, it's fine. So this object is a one form, and I take just the phi component here because it's codimension 2, so it's integrated over the circle. And by some kind of a weird coincidence, it just turns out that this relative corner term is exactly these two corner terms that you need for both renormalization and integrability of the charge. So that's a very curious thing. But what's even more curious is that for some reason, it's actually this corner term but with a minus sign. So this means that we should not interpret this in the wrong way. It does not mean that the first order Einstein-Cartan formulation already has the right symplectic structure to get the integrable charges. In fact, it doesn't, because you have to use this corner term with actually the wrong sign. So both in the case of Einstein-Hilbert and Einstein-Cartan, you have to renormalize and to introduce this integrability corner term. For Einstein-Hilbert, you have to put this corner term once, and for Einstein-Cartan, you have to put it actually twice because of this minus sign. So that's a bit puzzling, I think. And I think I mentioned this because I think it's a bit maybe a challenge for all these. No, there's no sign mistake.
So Simone is saying that Mark made a sign mistake, but Simone is wrong. You have to talk into the pack, you know.
In fact, there is no sign mistake actually, because there is nothing to compute. In fact, you just take the theta of Einstein-Hilbert, you evaluate it on shell, it diverges. You take the theta of Einstein-Cartan, you evaluate it on shell, it diverges, just twice as much. Yeah. There is a
hockey stick if you want.
Of course, I thought it was a sign mistake, but it's But still, it's strange, and I think it's maybe a challenge or a question for. We have seen many proposals for kind of proposing reformulations of the covariant phase space, which cure these ambiguities. So it would be nice to see a proposal which actually nicely knows about these extra terms, which you have to play with by hand. But at least here, you know what the terms are. You know what the answer should be. And the answer should just be that, of course, the charge is integrable. And the finite charge is given, again, in terms of this covariant mass and angular momentum. So as usual, you have super translations with the mass, super rotations g with angular momentum. You have this Weyl factor h with this subleading term c. And you have this radial translation k with the conformal factor of the angular metric. So it's a bit the opposite role that you would expect. But still, this means that
H is the Weyl.
H is Weyl, yes. So H is talking to the subleading of the transverse metric, and the translation is talking to the conformal factor somehow.
Very good. We use this second just to switch so we have the laser pointer back on. And the question of Laurent was about H, and you already replied to the question. I hope it was clear also from the virtual audience. And just to mention, more or less 5 minutes.
I'm almost done, yeah. So just wanted to mention that this is 3D, so it's topological. So as you expect, the charges are completely, are independent, in fact. This charge is true at any distance, in fact. So there is no subleading term in this charge. It's exact, thanks. Again, it's an example here of these leaky boundary conditions in the sense that, again, it's topological. There is no radiation, so the charge is integrable. However, it's not conserved, because if you compute the time variation of this, well, because we have these boundary sources for the boundary metric, their time evolution is completely free. And if you don't specify their time evolution, you compute the time evolution of the charge, it's just something non-vanishing. It's an example of this charge which is integrable but not conserved.
I have a question for you, sorry. Can I interrupt
now?
What does it mean, leaky boundary condition in a topological theory?
Well, that's why I put between, that's exactly why I have quotation marks.
Ah, okay. Okay, that's
because
the reason.
Because it's leaky in the sense not conserved, okay. But the non-conservation is not sourced by a flux of radiation.
Okay.
Non-conservation is sourced by the fact that the boundary metric can live its own life.
And is the action principle that you get stationary?
You can actually find a boundary Lagrangian to make it stationary, yes.
And in that choice of boundary Lagrangian are still non-conserved, the charges?
Yes. You need to further impose Dirichlet to have stationarity and conservation.
Thanks.
And just, okay, it's not so important, but just to mention, of course, you can compute the algebra. If you have lambda, it's double Vira 0 plus. In fact, H and K, they just have a central extension. They're abelian with a central extension. So it's in Heisenberg algebra. And in the flat case, you have BMS3 plus Heisenberg. Now, just also a curious remark, it's the fact that actually you can show that these two extra contributions, so from Weyl and from these translations, you can actually remove them with a corner term. So if you allow yourself to completely play with these ambiguities, well, at the end of the day, you can actually remove these contributions. But there is nothing here which is, in a sense, forcing you to do it. So I think the question is whether you should take these contributions seriously or not. One way to argue in favor of keeping them is to go to actually topologically massive gravity. So as you may know, it's like in 3D Maxwell theory, you can give a gauge invariant mass to the photon by coupling 2 plus 1 Maxwell to Trans-Siemens theory, abelian Trans-Siemens. You can do the same thing in gravity. That's a simple model called topologically massive gravity. You just take Einstein-Hilbert plus the Trans-Siemens term for the Levi-Civita connection. You can also do this in first order. In fact, the upshot of this is that if you compute the TMG contribution to the charge, well, you have this contribution, and you see that in this contribution, you can actually not, with this corner term, you cannot anymore remove the Weyl contribution. So this Weyl contribution, no matter what you do, I think will be here in this TMG sector. You also see, I wrote this to illustrate the fact that you have this it's obvious if you see from this Lagrangian here, in 2 plus 1, also in 4 dimensions, there are dual Lagrangians. This is an example where you write a Lagrangian which is dual to Einstein-Hilbert. And you see the duality is the fact that with the supertranslations, you have the angular momentum with lambda. And with the superrotations, you have the mass. So you are switching the role of both. So this is also to say that in 4 dimensions, these dualities should also maybe be interesting if you relax this extra boundary structure which we have here. So to conclude, we have seen that even if you use this partial Bondi gauge, it's not a complete gauge fixing, but still you can go ahead and just do everything. In particular, I think what's interesting, you can keep the logarithmic terms. So I think maybe before, I don't know, maybe we thought that it was very complicated to deal with these polyhomogeneous spacetimes, but maybe it's actually tractable. And this just extends, in a sense, to 4 dimensions, a toy model in 3D in which you can understand everything nicely. So there's lots of extra structure to play with, and of course now the goal is to understand which of these structures is really actually relevant. And so to do this, I think there are different prospects. So of course, the obvious thing to do is to compute the charge algebra in this generalized Newman-Unti gauge to see if this extra translation is actually associated to a physical charge. If it's associated to a physical charge, then I think that would be very interesting. Now the next thing to do is to actually work out the detailed logarithmic structure of the standard, for example, Bondi-Zaks gauge. And this is important because we need to understand further this relationship with the logarithmic contributions to the soft theorems. So we need to have a classical GR Bondi type setup where we can understand these logarithmic contributions. And if these logarithmic contributions are here, we should try to work out the implications for celestial holography and Karolian holography. We can also investigate the coupling of this to matter, because maybe coupling the theory to matter is a way to actually give life to these extra Weyl symmetries and this radial translation. And maybe also something that's not very, I think that's interesting to study, is to study radiation in ADS and memory effects in ADS. And as you saw here, we have recovered some earlier results by Geoffrey, Romain, Adrien about the symplectic structure in ADS and the role of the radiation tensor. And there's an interesting paper by Alice Serrache who actually showed that, or argued, and don't understand completely, but at least that this scalar mode that we have in the Newman-Unti gauge, this trace of C, could be related to what is called breathing memory in scalar tensor theories. That's maybe a setup where this extra mode would acquire a physical meaning. And of course, what you could do is something even wilder and further relaxations of the gauge. In particular, I think in this fluid approach, people like to relax these components so that then they have access to an extra 2D vector, because A is free now, and this vector is very useful in the fluid gravity correspondence. And thank you.
Thank you very much. First hand raised was Antonis.
I wanted to ask about the funny signed quarter term thing.
Yes.
Maybe Luca asked this, I didn't quite catch. Did you say there is like a choice of boundary Lagrangian and a variational principle associated with that choice? And
that's another puzzle which I didn't mention. I think Céline is working on this, but so you can do 2 things. This is what happens with the corner terms. Then you find the proper, I can also write a nice metric covariant form for this corner term. Uh-huh. And then you can also make the action principle well-defined, mm-hmm. and in particular finite, the Jonschel action finite. Mm-hmm. You can find the boundary Lagrangian for this. At least in this first version of the paper, we could not find actually a boundary Lagrangian which gives both rise to this potential and to renormalize the action principle. So, but maybe it's because we're missing some extra structure on the boundary, some extra terms we can play with. It would have been nice if immediately, you know, it's easy to write a boundary Lagrangian which gives this symplectic potential. It would have been nice if from the onset, this boundary Lagrangian is the one which renormalizes the Jonschel action. And that's not the case.
Yeah. Okay. And just real quick, when you wrote down the the algebra, do you get like the correct value for the central, the Virasoro central charge, or does it, is it affected by?
No, it's not affected. It's the standard.
So yeah. It's the standard one. Okay.
Yeah, maybe just before Laurent, can you hear me? Yes, just before Laurent, sorry. I just wanted to make a comment. The question about the fact that the action principle was stationary is that I think you can prove in general in 3D that if you're talking about Einstein, so a topological theory, and you can find a stationary action by adding any possible ambiguity, etc., then the charges are automatically conserved. You have to play with all possible kind of slicing, et cetera, et cetera. It's not a trivial thing to show, but you can show it, I think. So that's why I was asking, if you can make it stationary and you're talking about Einstein and not TMG, then I'm worried that maybe the conservation can be absorbed somehow. So maybe you were in a setup in which it was stationary and on Einstein, and it was not conserved. This could happen, but I think that this conservation, non-conservation could be reabsorbed by studying other. Yeah, but it's independent on that. I think, well, we can discuss about it. It's just a comment. I'm not saying that. Laurent had a question.
Yeah, I have a question about something you mentioned, which I find interesting and puzzling, is the fact that somehow the large R limit and the lambda goes to zero limit, they don't commute, right? So let's say if you imagine that you take, for people who believe maybe you should have a, you know, your theory with a small lambda and then take lambda to zero. Does that mean that maybe, you know, this idea that maybe a small lambda and then, you know, could be a regularization factor for these scattering processes that people look in flat space? Or how do you take that? Like somehow it looks like if you have the log R, somehow this somehow makes flat space completely in not the same class as ADS.
But I think I would rather, instead of using lambda as a regulator to argue that you could forget about these terms, I would rather take the flat lesson seriously.
But it means in that case they have to be reabsorbed in some way.
Yes, but I think this
to be connected to a non-zero cosmological constant.
Yes, but I think this is what we should understand. Because these logarithmic terms, they're already here in just classical gravitational scattering. They are unavoidable, so.
Are there other questions? Simone, are you sure about the sign? Do you want to check again? I was sure about it. Let me try.
Giocavo portiere da giovane. No, because you at some point you mentioned relaxing also G little r a. I was wondering, but like last year there was a paper. Well, there was a finite distance, but still, I think Daniel Grumiller and collaborators were looking at just relaxing everything. And on a null surface, they were just requiring to satisfy that G U U is equal to zero, and that's it. So
yes.
Maybe you could consider also their situation. That was on a finite distance. I don't think they were looking at the limit.
Yes.
But it is in the setting.
Coming
of
from Trans-Simons theory, they had some argument that you could have this most general flat space and ADS boundary conditions. And I think the statement was that they actually get six charges. So I think it's probably correct, because if you're very simple-minded about 3D gravity, 3D gravity in the first order formulation gives you for free six charges, which are integrable, and but they're just they're charges of a current algebra, not of a diffeomorphism algebra. The problem is how you go from the current algebra to the diffeomorphism algebra. This is what brings in, again, this apparent non-integrability because of this psi theta piece. But probably there is a... But that's also a question for here, is how you could further relax the gauge so as to have maybe actually six charges and not just four. But if you relax it further, I'm worried about, as soon as you break this Bondi hierarchy, it's not clear how you solve the equations of motion and how you...
All right, so I propose that we thank Mark again for the next talk.
Sure.